listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of the autopsy report by Gabriel Sherman. In the end, they settled. On September 8, 2025, 1 year after the Nevada court showdown, the Murdochs reached an accord that fulfilled Rupert's wish that Lachlan would inherit the empire. Under the terms of the deal, James, Liz, and Prue forfeited their voting rights to choose a successor and each received $1.1 billion. A new trust was created that would benefit Lachlan and Rupert's youngest children, Grace and Chloe. The deal proved Rupert's philosophy that money always wins. Everyone had reasons to settle. For James, Liz, and Prue, Gorman's ruling looked less certain once Rupert and Lachlan appealed in January. That uncertainty was made especially clear in May, when Nevada Appeals Court Judge Lynn Jones indicated she was sympathetic to Rupert's argument that he amended the trust to protect the business. "Who knows better than Rupert Murdoch the strengths and weaknesses of his family and his children," she said in court. Donald Trump's election, too, had shifted the culture in Rupert and Lachlan's favor, according to one of their advisors. And Rupert's age also functioned as a ticking clock. At 94, he might not survive the appeals process. Despite all the emotional blood spilled, Liz and Prue wanted closure with their father before he died. By the time it was over, the common front around the rebellious children had cracked. Liz resented being portrayed in the media as a plotter in James's coup-in-waiting. She never wanted to dethrone Lachlan. She simply objected to Rupert rewriting the rules. This was about principle, not power. But principle had limits. As her advisor explained of her decision to settle, "No one wants to be king of the graveyard. She could fight this, but by the time it ends, so much blood will have been spilled that everyone's dead." Of all the siblings, James had positioned himself as the moral conscience of the family. He resigned from the News Corp board because of disagreements over certain editorial content. He told The Atlantic that a good company wouldn't lie to juice ratings. He funded progressive causes and spoke of reforming media. But when the moment came to fight for actual reform of Fox News, when he could have used his position to push for change from within, he took $1.1 billion and walked away. Prudence, Elizabeth, and James are pleased that the matter is now behind them, James's spokesperson said. His moral awakening, it turned out, had a price tag. For Lachlan, the battle left him victorious but vulnerable. To buy out his siblings, Lachlan sold Fox and News Corp shares that reduced his control over the company's boards to 36% and 33%. That smaller stake means his perch is vulnerable to an activist investor in the future. Fox News remains as dominant as ever. In September, the cable network averaged 2.54 million viewers, more than CNN and MSNBC combined. But Fox's core 25 to 54-year-old demographic shrank 14% as news consumers increasingly got their news online from social media, TikTok, and podcast. Tabloids, once the engine of the empire's growth, are now on occasional liability. In January 2025, the Sun's parent company issued an unequivocal apology to Prince Harry for phone hacking and paid substantial damages. Lachlan is also navigating Rupert's fraught relationship with Trump. In July, Trump sued Rupert for $20 billion after the Wall Street Journal reported Trump had contributed a signed drawing of a naked woman as part of a 50th birthday gift for Jeffrey Epstein, who was later convicted as a sex offender. Happy birthday, and may every day be another wonderful secret, Trump wrote to Epstein in 2003, according to the Journal. He denied making the drawing. Trump told people that Rupert deceived him. Rupert assured Trump it wouldn't run, said a person who spoke with Trump at the time. The Journal stood by its story, with a representative telling reporters, "We have full confidence in the vigor and accuracy of our reporting and will vigorously defend against any lawsuit." In September, despite his $20 billion lawsuit, Trump offered Rupert a minority stake in the consortium to acquire the U.S. operations of TikTok. Rupert accepted. The man who once dictated terms was now taking what Trump offered. After decades building his empire through conquest and control, Rupert was now agreeing to be a minority stakeholder in a Chinese app. The Murdoch empire still mattered. Fox News still moved Republican politics. The newspapers still influenced elites. But power was shifting to platforms Rupert couldn't own and personalities he couldn't control. Lachlan, Grace, and Chloe inherited an empire that, while still powerful, no longer set the terms of the game. Lachlan got the kingdom. James, Liz, and Prue got their freedom. In early August, a rumor swirled through New York media circles that Rupert was very sick and possibly dying. But later that month, news outlets reported he had dinner with the Greek prime minister at a seaside taverna on the island of Tinos. During a month when billionaires gathered their families on their yachts, Rupert was with his fifth wife while his children were scattered across the globe. He was still in the game, even if he played alone. This article is copyright 2026 by Gabriel Sherman from the forthcoming book Bonfire of the Murdochs, How the Epic Fight to Control the Last Great Media Dynasty Broke a Family and the World, by Gabriel Sherman, to be published by Simon & Schuster, LLC, printed by permission. This ain't no disco. Saturday night, Penn Social is your typical D.C. dive, filled with conservative 20-somethings. Come Sunday morning, it's still a hot spot, but by the name of King's Church. Reports Tara Palmieri, where the same cool kids congregate, professing their faith in Jesus and in Donald Trump. Opening photo shows a neon sign that says Jesus Saves, lit up in red with a white crown on the top. Trays of shots sit waiting on the bar. Behind them, the mini-fridges of Red Bull hum softly, and a row of beer taps dormant for now. In less than an hour, those taps will be flowing again. But for the moment, they frame a congregation of 720-somethings, many of them White House and Capitol aides, think tank staffers, bureaucrats, and interns, standing shoulder to shoulder with their hands raised toward the disco lights as if beseeching them for guidance. The shots aren't tequila. They are the blood of Christ, passed around on silver trays and swallowed in unison, the world's most pious drinking game. On stage, musicians scroll through New Age worship lyrics on iPhones, propped on tripods, where hymnals once might have been. The effect is half revival, half silent disco. This ain't no disco. It's King's Church, one of Washington's fastest-growing evangelical congregations, holding Sunday service inside Penn Social, the downtown bar, better known for its Tuesday beer pong tournaments and congressional mixers. Just a few blocks from the White House, King's Church has become a magnet for ambitious young conservatives, people who spend their weekdays drafting talking points, staffing hearings, and chasing proximity to power. It's a place where faith feels more like a networking event than a ritual, the kind of juxtaposition only Washington could pull off, communion by shot glass, salvation with a side of brunch. My kind of people. During the sermon, co-founder and pastor Wesley Welch, 34, tells a story about unused gift cards as a metaphor for Christians failing to cash in their spiritual balance, quoting a Pew Research poll on prayer, like a campaign briefing. This is Washington. Even God can use better data. Welch, tall and slender with a soft beard and soft voice, wears a black suit and floral tie and explains he's finally reached the stage in life where he can afford to buy, not rent, a tuxedo. And thanks to an old Joseph A. Bank gift card, he could buy a dress shirt, too. He sticks strictly to the Book of Daniel, reading almost straight from Scripture in a circuitous way. It is almost shocking the crowd doesn't peel off for TikTok. They had one shirt in my size, he marvels, and the price was exactly what the gift card covered. He treats the coincidence as a divine nudge, delivered through a mall menswear chain famous for buy one, get three deals. A member of the Southern Baptist Convention, one of the largest Protestant denominations in the country, and also one of the most conservative, King's Church has engineered a recruitment machine that any political strategist would envy. Its ministry seems to target the interns who pour into the city each semester, offering community, mentorship, and purpose wrapped in worship. Many soon land full-time jobs, carrying the church's DNA with them. What began in 2008 with 50 worshipers in a Courtyard by Marriott conference room moved to the International Spy Museum, because of course it did, then to a high school auditorium, and now a 13,000-square-foot bar so packed that latecomers stand along the walls. While many of D.C.'s brick-and-mortar churches struggle to fill 100 seats, King's draws hundreds of 20-somethings in Lilly Pulitzer dresses and dry-fit polos, coffee cups in hand, swaying beneath yellow and purple lights instead of a cross. Instead of a past basket for offerings, a QR code for the church's Venmo account glows on the wall. There's an app, too, where worshipers can join small groups and give donations. On their website, worshipers can find roommates, view job openings, listen to the podcast, and find community through joining GroupMe threads and a surprisingly active Instagram. The service even begins with a selfie of a newly engaged couple projected on the wall. After 2.5 hours, when the music stops, no one bolts. They stack their chairs and pull back the curtains, revealing the full stretch of the bar, the arcade, the skee ball, the basketball hoops, and then they network. At the door, a large man named Daquan Bruce, 29, acts as bouncer, greeter, philosopher. Bruce moonlights as a cable news pundit and is the head of public relations at Westwind Elements. We talk about the intersection of faith and, like your career growth, he tells me, at a baptism in June. The man behind him adds, God transcends politics. Perhaps, but in Washington, politics devours everything, even the sacred. It's a power center, says Matthew Bartlett, a former Trump administration appointee, maybe even a nerve center in this new administration, the connective tissue between worship, ideology, and networking. And among the power players in D.C., it's only rising. That rise was clearest when 35-year-old co-founder Ben Palka was ushered into the Pentagon orbit by Pete Hegseth to speak in October behind the Department of War seal at one of Hegseth's Christian prayer and worship services. The initiative has already been criticized for treating the separation of church and state as more of a suggestion rather than a rule. It has featured speakers like Doug Wilson, who leads Hegseth's church and who has advocated for a male-led Christian society. Palka's presence there signaled something unmistakable. Washington is starting to treat him less like a pastor and more like a player. Senator Josh Hawley has also taken notice of King's, posting a highly produced video to his 2.4 million followers on X of his October speech on Christian manhood, Secrets of a Meaningful Life. The clip intercuts Capitol Hill cityscapes with excerpts of his remarks, a glossy signal that prominent conservatives see the church as a stage worth claiming. When asked if a Democratic leader has spoken to the congregation, Welch did not respond. Live, laugh, love. We're not super right-wing, Palka insists. He often mentions having Biden staffers in the congregation, though none of the more than 30 church members I interviewed could point one out. Still, he takes his influence seriously. Very sincerely, he tells me, and with a fear of God before my eyes. At the heart of King's Church lies the King's Collective, a semester-long internship ministry marketed with the branding precision of a Hill comms shop. Officially, it's a discipleship program to carry the gospel into their internships. Unofficially, it's a spiritual LinkedIn. They teach how to maintain your Christian identity in politics, but for interns, says Will S., 33, who works in national security. I don't know any other church that seeks after interns the way King's does. The congregants are media savvy. Many refuse to give full names to avoid appearing to speak for their offices. You know, politics is very scary, says Bennett Young, a senior at the University of Mississippi, who's interning for Marjorie Taylor Greene. But if you see people that you work with coming into church every Sunday, it means a lot. Young says everyone in Greene's office embraces the church, so much so that you can imagine the pressure interns feel to show face. During a baptism service in June, I find myself seated next to a woman who describes herself as Senator Katie Britz, Republican, Alabama, intern coordinator, who brought two staffers. Another young woman said she was encouraged to recruit from her office. Lydia, 23, found King's through a colleague at the Leadership Institute. She later networked her way into the Heritage Foundation, another institution with a conspicuously strong presence here. Brad Robertson, the 26-year-old college and intern director, worked there. So did lay pastor Daniel Davis. The pitch is irresistible for any ambitious 20-something alone in the Capitol, instant community, and a fast pass to relevance. It's really helpful for interns to hear, maybe from a lawyer's perspective, or a lobbyist, or maybe someone who works on the Hill, says another intern from Green's office who declined to give her name. They help a lot with different opportunities. The men behind King's Church understand this dynamic intimately. So, for me, D.C. was my kind of people, says Palka, Welch's co-founder. I like politics. I like the drama of it. I want to reach and impact these kinds of people. I wanted to be rubbing shoulders with these kinds of people. Welch and Palka are an unlikely pair. Welch has the warmth of a Southern youth pastor. He grew up in an evangelical family in Georgia. Palka, with a flat top and clean shave, looks more like a Marine than a minister. He grew up in Buffalo with a Catholic father and Episcopalian mother who baptized him in a bathtub, a decision that still mystifies him. A lifelong student government kid, he found God in college, wandering into a church service. After the service, I visit their row house near Capitol Hill. Next to a mechanic's garage, it feels more like a frat annex than a rectory. Spotlights illuminate built-in bookshelves. A framed QR code for the church app, Home Goods style Live, Laugh, Love decor, and inspirational Christian titles like Love Your Church by their mentor Tony Merida and The Reason for God by Timothy Keller, whose Manhattan movement, Redeemer City to City Church, similarly drew young urban professionals into a powerful finance and art network. Upstairs, the counseling room features a green velvet swivel chair, a tufted brown leather couch, a paper lamp, and a raw wood table. A gilded frame of the Last Supper is tucked in the corner. Palka explains that he abandoned a career in defense contracting and even turned down an FBI job to pursue ministry. After struggling for 2 years to grow beyond 50 congregants, he and Welch gained traction by tapping interns from Liberty University, which now funnels students into King's each semester. It also helps that they remained open throughout most of COVID. They met at an ice cream shop near the Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, where they studied under church planter Merida. There, they formed their plan, Storm Washington. 8 years, 250 baptisms. Washington has always attracted spiritual entrepreneurs, from pastors seeking proximity, to presidents, to Christian nationalists eager to break down the wall between church and state. Recently, megachurches with deep pockets have made their move. Passion City from Atlanta expanded to D.C. in 2018, and more recently, Christian nationalist Wilson, the Idaho pastor and advisor to Hegseth, helped launch Christ Church on Capitol Hill last summer at the Conservative Partnership Institute. We understand that worship is warfare. We mean that, Pastor Jared Longshore warned in one of Wilson's services, according to Christianity Today. The timing, paired with the zealotry at Charlie Kirk's funeral and Trump's revival of the White House Faith Office, has made a soft theocracy feel less fringe and more inevitable. But Welch and Palka aren't fire and brimstone populists. They are careful, disciplined. They speak moderation while building something more durable, nurturing a generation of young conservatives who will carry their teachings into agencies, congressional offices, the judiciary, and a returning Republican administration. So does King's function as a soft power pipeline for young conservatives in Washington? Its leaders bristle at the suggestion. We have nothing to do with getting people jobs. We have never, ever, ever done that, says Palka. I do think it could be a byproduct, though. Part of the Christian faith is that we don't compartmentalize it, says Welch. So we want people to see that it does influence your career, just like how your faith influences your family, your relationships, your kids. So that's just natural to how the church operates. It's not like this is the goal. King's has done 250 baptisms in 8 years. Palka jokes more than once that I could be baptized at their next ceremony. When I ask how long it takes to join the church, he smiles. It could take 15 minutes. It could take 15 years. He believes Gen Z is drawn not to megachurch gimmicks like slingshots and ziplining pastors, but to ancient ritual. Kings recites the Nicene Creed weekly, rare among evangelical churches. Members must affirm 9 core beliefs: God as Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Jesus fully God and fully human, born of a virgin, lived without sin, died, rose again, and will return to judge the living and the dead. Scripture is final. The church must carry out Christ's mission until he returns. They're looking to retrieve some of those anchors that have been lost, Palka says. That is something the young people are flocking to, the high church liturgy. Space, not attendance, is King's real problem. Expansion plans to cities like Paris and Berlin are on hold until they secure a permanent space in D.C., and they need money. Their flock consists largely of interns and junior staffers, earnest but broke. Palka knows that securing a physical home would give Kings another ring of relevance, one more proof point that the church can be an institution. We thought we'd have a building by now, says Palka. You can hit up a denomination for funding, but this capital campaign, it's been very slow. Worshippers show up a half hour early to claim seats, and some longtime congregants have grumbled about the intern influx. One faction, calling itself King's Church Members Take a Stand, lines the back wall to save room for newcomers. They launched with a $50,000 loan from the Southern Baptist Convention's North American Mission Board, small by megachurch standards, but enough to launch a movement. I would love if we had a building of our own one day, Palka says. All the statistics say it gives the church credibility. It makes it more real in people's eyes when you see that it's their location. Robertson, the 26-year-old running the intern ministry, may be one of the church's most influential figures. It's a really interesting city, he says. The fact that 25-year-olds kind of run the government, he is, in effect, their shepherd. Conservatism, Inc. For interns living on stipends, King's offers free lunches, nationals tickets, and speaker events featuring K Street veterans, senior aides, operatives, and even a Fox News producer. There are mixers, too, where future staff assistants meet future legislative directors. For the Republican Party, that makes King's more than a church. It's a long-term investment. If someone here hears about an opportunity, like a staff position opening up, says Noah Larson, 25, an operations director and Representative Claudia Tinney's Republican New York office, I'll ask, just flag it for a minute and say, hey, you know, pass in your resume. He's already helping his twin brother find a job through the congregation. What makes King so startling, even unnerving, for the secular left is how effortlessly it fills a void progressives never cracked, blending identity, community, and political machinery. Conservatives have spent years perfecting what insiders call Conservatism, Inc., the pipeline of fellowships, think tank roles, K Street apprenticeships, and administration jobs. Seeing that ecosystem emerge inside a church signals an escalation. I've seen Conservatism, Inc. working to engage churches, says Tina Nguyen, author of the MAGA Diaries, but I've never seen something like a church become a networking hub for young career conservatives. To start at the tail end of the first Trump administration and to be catching fire now with the returning Republican administration is great timing, says Gary Marks, the former executive director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition and a veteran of Bush-Cheney. National Community Church, once the underground church frequented by conservative staffers on the Hill that grew from Union Station's basement movie theater into a Northern Virginia megachurch, never built a pipeline like this. King's is different. It is strategic, hungry, and very aware of its moment. At $2,200 per Sunday, the church has the venue only until 1 p.m. As Palka shepherds people up the stairwell, pop begins to blare, a photo booth rolls across the bar, high tops scrape into place, and arcade games flicker back to life before football fans pour in for their own kind of ritual devotion. The church members disperse into the city to their legislative memos and policy drafts, carrying with them the gospel and the group chat. A new power is taking root in Washington. It doesn't march or lobby or storm the Capitol. It pours coffee, sings under disco lights, baptizes interns, and sends them into the machinery of government. And it grows every Sunday. A.B. Baker contributed reporting to this story. Now here's the Proust Questionnaire with a portrait by Gil Button, Keith McNally, the restaurateur, memoirist, and champion Instagram captioner, happily names names, but has regrets as well. Admiring Woody Allen is not one of them. What is your idea of perfect happiness, taking an overnight train in Europe? On what occasion do you lie when I want to sleep with someone? Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Can't make your dinner party because I have COVID. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Shoeless Joe Jackson. What is your greatest fear? My children dying before me. Which living person do you most admire? Woody Allen. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Craving the kind of success I pretend to despise. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Using knowledge as a weapon. What is your greatest extravagance? Basking in a modesty I don't possess. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Conspicuous humility. What do you dislike most about your appearance? A voice that's shot to pieces. What is your greatest regret? Not having regular checkups before my stroke. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My 6-year-old granddaughter, Olive. When and where were you happiest? Cycling around Martha's Vineyard alone in the summer of 1976. Which talent would you most like to have? The talent to look into a mirror and not despise the person staring at me. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? To be more straightforward, I think. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Commit to memory the Philip Larkin line, they F you up, your mom and dad. What do you consider your greatest achievement? The failure of my suicide attempt in 2018. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Orson Welles. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? Lake Geneva. What is your most treasured possession? A belief in due process. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Weddings. What is your favorite occupation? Sports writer. What is your most marked characteristic? Fear of embarrassing myself. What is your motto? When being tortured, name names. Who are your favorite writers? Shakespeare, Thomas Hardy, Chekhov, Jane Austen, Guy de Maupassant, Dickens, Tolstoy, and John Cheever. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Alec Lemus, the anti-hero, and John le Carré's The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. Who are your heroes in real life? Steffi Graf and former UK politician Rory Stewart. What are your favorite names? Fanny Squeers and Augustus Snodgrass, characters from Dickens novels. What is it that you most dislike? Inauthenticity. How would you like to die? During sexual intercourse. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Keith McNally. American Gothic. John F. Kennedy Jr. and Carolyn Bessette Kennedy were a seemingly perfect couple who met a perfectly tragic ending. Chris Murphy explains why we're still obsessed with them and introduces Paul Anthony Kelly and Sarah Pidgeon, who bring the doomed pair back to life in Ryan Murphy's love story. Photographer Jeremy Liebman contributed to this article. You already know how the story ends. On July 16, 1999, John F. Kennedy Jr., the son of JFK and Jackie O., and his wife, Carolyn Bessette Kennedy, died when the small plane John was flying crashed somewhere off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. Carolyn's older sister, Lauren, was also on the plane and perished in the crash as well. It took 5 days for authorities to recover their bodies from the ocean floor. That's the tragic conclusion Ryan Murphy's newest TV series inevitably hurtles toward, and also where it begins. Love Story, John F. Kennedy Jr. and Carolyn Bessette, opens with the doomed couple's rather mundane final moments on the ground. Carolyn switches her nail color from a bold red to a blander shade. John hobbles out of his George Magazine office wearing a cast on his left ankle due to a paragliding accident. They can't stop bickering once they arrive at the tarmac, their relationship seemingly on the brink as they prepare for what would be their last flight. It's hard to overstate John and Carolyn's tangible influence on New York in the 1990s. How different their era was from today's fractured media landscape. From birth, John had been America's first son, the boy who saluted his father's coffin. Now that he was all grown up, the tabloids followed his every move. Sometimes they were complimentary. He was the fourth guy ever to be named People's Sexiest Man Alive. Other times, not so much. After John failed the New York State bar exam for the second time, the New York Daily News ran a stinging headline, "The Hunk Flunks Again." Things weren't any easier for Carolyn. A sales clerk plucked from a Calvin Klein store to work at the brand's New York HQ, Carolyn was thrust into the spotlight rather than born into it. As a publicist and eventually a public figure, Carolyn helped launch the career of Kate Moss and brought brands like Miu Miu and Issey Miyake into the mainstream, but she chafed against her celebrity. Nevertheless, her cultural impact far surpassed her career, which was cut short even before she died. She had abandoned it to become a full-time Kennedy wife. Every time you see a glamorous woman crossing a cobblestone street in a neutral yet impeccably tailored ensemble from Prada or Yamamoto or one of those brands' clear descendants like the Row or Kite, you can thank Carolyn. Murphy scoured the globe to find actors to convincingly portray John and his mysterious wife. After thousands of auditions, he and his creative team landed on relative unknowns, Paul Anthony Kelly and Sarah Pidgeon. The Canadian Kelly was plugging away behind a sales register in Toronto when, just like Carolyn's, his life changed in an instant. "I got scouted in an American Apparel on Queen Street East," he says. A week later, he was walking the runway at Milan Fashion Week and later modeling for Brooks Brothers. It's not hard to see why. Wearing vintage Armani slacks, a black Zegna button-down, and a Paul Smith leather jacket, Kelly is almost comically handsome. Acting initially came to him as a byproduct of his day job modeling. But like many of his fellow travelers, success didn't happen overnight. He spent 13 years auditioning and moonlighting in community theater because I had to do something, he says. But Kelly didn't book a major job till Love Story. The same can't be said for Pidgeon, a waifish Michigan native who attended two prestigious drama schools back-to-back, Interlochen Arts Academy and Carnegie Mellon, and was cast in the Amazon Prime series The Wilds, straight out of school. Then came the role that changed her life, Diana, the lead singer of a Fleetwood Mac-esque band in David Ajmi's Tony-winning play, Stereophonic. It was a huge challenge, she says. I had to sing, had to scream, had to cry, and I had to do it over and over and over again. She got a Tony nomination for her trouble. Pigeon's task was equal and opposite to Kelly's. How do you convincingly portray a woman who's both iconic and an enigma? While there are hundreds of photographs of Carolyn, she never gave an official interview. Search for clips of her speaking voice, and you'll find less than 18 seconds recorded for public consumption. In some ways, that's what's so intimidating about it, says Pigeon. It really required me to make a choice on how I wanted to represent her. John, meanwhile, had been in the public eye since birth, and there's endless information about him. To an actor, this could be seen as an advantage, especially for a Canadian trying to master the distinctive Kennedy lockjaw accent. Junior narrates his father's book, so I listen to that every day before I go to work, Kelly says. Everything's very well documented, so it was easy to just be a sponge and let the algorithm show me everything. But the algorithm can be a fickle mistress. When the show posted a few initial test shots of Pigeon in costume as Carolyn, the images went viral in a negative way, with armchair critics across the globe nitpicking its costumes and styling, and even the shade of Pigeon's newly dyed blonde hair. It wasn't surprising to me that people had strong opinions, Pigeon says of the drama. These people are very beloved. There's a lot of familiarity with them. Through this process, she's become very important to me. So I guess it wasn't just a huge shock that people had feedback about it. While Pigeon took the criticism in stride, Murphy and company seemed to take it to heart, letting go of the show's original costume designer and hiring a new one, Rudy Mance, weeks after production on the series began in June. People, myself included, feel protective of them and their image because what happened to them was so tragic, says Mance. The scrutiny was unlike anything Pigeon had faced in her career thus far. I've never been working on something while knowing that there is a conversation being had about it, she says. This process has been about figuring out how I navigate that. I've come to understand that I just have to focus on the story that we're telling. Ever the supportive scene partner, Kelly agrees. I think it really shows how much people care, he says, of the hoopla. It shows that people are excited for it, which reignites my excitement for it, getting to go to work and breathe life into these characters. I think people are going to be really happy with what we've done, what we've created here. Derogatory discourse isn't the only noise they've had to shut out. The same year Pigeon and Kelly shot Love Story, President Donald Trump tapped Robert F. Kennedy Jr., John's cousin, to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, giving the former lawyer a powerful platform to promote conspiracy theories about the supposed dangers of vaccines, fluoride, seed oils, and Tylenol, among other things. Jack Schlossberg, John's nephew, is on the opposite side of the ideological spectrum and recently announced that he's running for Congress in New York, but has made his disdain for Murphy and the entire Love Story production well known. In a since-deleted social media post, Schlossberg threatened to come to the Love Story set to give Murphy a piece of his mind. He later told the New York Times that he was messing around. They're a very big family. There's a lot of them, says Pigeon, when I ask about RFK Jr. and Schlossberg. I don't know the first thing about what it's like to have a story or stories. She stops short, reconsiders. We're not the first to examine the Kennedys in any way, but it's really cool to know that we're doing a project that's based off a family that is so prevalent. A nervous Kelly echoes his more seasoned co-star. I now have to piggyback, he says, after some cajoling. The Kennedys seem to do everything without effort, but you can almost see the sweat trickling down Kelly's neck. Even the least superstitious among us would be hard-pressed to deny that an abnormal amount of terrible things have happened to the Kennedy family. Joe Jr. died in combat. JFK and RFK were assassinated. John and Carolyn weren't even the first Kennedys to die tragically in a plane crash. Despite this, and despite the tragedies the family bears some responsibility for, like Chappaquiddick and Rosemary's lobotomy, the Kennedy family's legacy has stretched far beyond the 1,000-odd days JFK served as the nation's youngest president. Love Story promises to explore that dynasty, diving deep into a dazzling and damned family by way of the Kennedys, who may have shined the brightest and suffered the most. The facts we do know are sometimes stranger than fiction. Fugees member Wyclef Jean performed at JFK Jr.'s funeral in 1999 because John was such a big fan. Carolyn was annoyed by Gwyneth Paltrow and was best friends with future Real Housewife Carol Radziwill, who was married to John's cousin Anthony Radziwill. We know that John and Carolyn were in love, the emotions practically pouring out of the photos from their small wedding at the First African Baptist Church on Cumberland Island in Georgia, where Carolyn wore an instantly trend-setting $40,000 wedding dress designed by her friend Calvin Klein alum Narciso Rodriguez. We also know that they fought. There's paparazzi footage of the couple screaming at and shoving each other in downtown Manhattan, painfully punctuated by John appearing to rip off Carolyn's engagement ring. All of this will play out in Love Story. If they had lived, would John have gone into politics like his father, his cousin, and his nephew? Would Carolyn have started her own fashion brand? Would they have stayed together or divorced? Could John, a nascent media mogul, have run this very magazine? We'll never know. The future's a mystery for Kelly and Pigeon as well, but at least for now it looks bright. My wife's here, she's pregnant, it's our first baby, says Kelly, his eyes gleaming. The projected due date is Carolyn Bessette Kennedy's birthday, he adds, January 7th. John never had a chance to become a father, but Kelly still feels this experience brings him closer to America's fallen first son. There are so many things that align with them and us and the show, he says, of John and Carolyn. It feels very meant to be. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.